From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Kansas City Royals' liberal use of pinch runners this season helped them get into the World Series. Ahead on Only a Game, a look at the speedsters who could help them prevail in the Fall Classic. Also, the case for giving ex-Giant Barry Bonds a bit of a break. The Los Angeles Clippers prepare for the post-Sterling era. A look at the widening academic scandal at the University of North Carolina, and two Jewish soccer teams make history on a Polish soccer pitch. Also ahead, Bob Ryan, sports scribe for half a century, talks about his new book and about the effect of social media on contemporary sports writing.
Most of this frenzy people have to be first involves two things, trades or signings. Are they that important that people have to go nuts daily over this? But that's what they do.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Kansas City offense stalled in Game 1 of the World Series on Tuesday, leaving many to wonder if the Royals would be able to revive their vaunted high-speed running game against the San Francisco Giants. But the home team did that in the sixth inning of Game 2 when Terrence Gore came in as a pinch runner and sparked a rally that helped even the series. Royals rooters are hoping that strategy will help propel their team to its first World Series championship in 29 years. Only a Game's Greg Eklund reports.
When Salvador Perez ended the 12-inning wildcard game against the Oakland Athletics with a game-winning single, Kauffman Stadium exploded. The Royals had seven stolen bases in that game. Going into the World Series, the San Francisco Giants were keenly aware of the Kansas City Royals' speed factor. In late-inning situations, Royals manager Ned Yost often uses outfielders Jerrod Dyson and Terrence Gore primarily as pinch runners.
Letting them do what they do best. You know, I don't think I've put a steel sign on all year. All of our running is green light stuff.
Dyson was promoted to the big leagues 4 years ago as a 50th round draft choice from a junior college in Mississippi. He has made an impact on the bases, stealing 36 in the regular season. Dyson steadfastly believes that good base running wins ball games, and he has a catchy expression to convey that idea.
That's what speed do.
Former major leaguer Matt Alexander has been closely observing the Royals this postseason.
I'm proud of them. They're doing good. I see a lot of speed. They're using their speed the right way.
Alexander's speed helped the Pittsburgh Pirates win the 1979 World Series. Alexander, better known as Scat, also holds the record for most career stolen bases by a pinch runner with 91. He especially likes Royals pinch runner Terrence Gore.
I feel he can break my record that I hold right now in the major leagues, and I've been having that record for like 35, 36 years. He probably can steal a lot of bases because I watch him on TV, and I can see that he really trying to key on certain thing about the pitcher, and he quick. You got to be quick. You got to have quick footwork.
Gore hasn't gotten many at-bats lately, but he knows why he's with the team. The soft-spoken Gore hopes to change that in the future.
Right now, my speed is what I'm focused on right now, but I'm always going to swing the bat a little bit. So
Jerrod Dyson has made more trips to the plate this postseason, but he admits that he'd like to do more one day than just run the bases.
I'm willing to do anything the team want me to do right now. We're not going to break up a good thing we got going right now. I just got to worry about next year when it happens, but yes, I would love for an everyday job. That's my goal. I don't want to bag up anymore.
The history of the pinch running specialist dates all the way back to the 1960s when the Athletics were located in Kansas City and owned by Charlie Finley. The first was Alan Lewis, listed as an outfielder, but the Panamanian Express was used mainly to run the bases. Then track star Herb Washington was signed by the A's in the early 1970s after their move to Oakland. He's the only player whose baseball card reads pinch runner on his position label. In 1973, Matt Alexander came to the big leagues with the Cubs and was traded to the Athletics as a replacement for Washington, who's infamous for getting picked off of first base in the 1974 World Series.
Well, he didn't have that baseball instinct because he never played the game. All he knew how to run a 100-yard dash. But, you know, he made some mistakes, and I think that's the reason why they went further to try to get a player that know how to steal but also know how to play a position.
Perhaps one day Gore and Dyson will have the opportunity to be everyday players, but for now they'll gladly concede the at-bats for the opportunity to win World Series rings. To repeat Dyson's expression...
That's what speed do.
For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund.
In October, baseball teams trot out the old guys for another round of applause, and at Game 4 of the National League Championship Series, San Francisco welcomed Barry Bonds to throw out the first pitch. Bonds gets a warm reception in the Bay Area, but many fans still view the all-time home run leader as the face of the steroids era. Michael Powell of the New York Times argues that Bonds gets too much blame when there's plenty to spread around. Michael, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Just to be clear, you're not saying Barry Bonds was innocent, but are you at the point where you can let him off the hook?
Right. Well, I'm certainly not saying he's innocent. And in fact, I have very little doubt that he did all sorts of things and ended up, you know, as bloated as Popeye as a result. But I am saying that he was a part of a bad era in baseball that extended from the players right on up with complete complicity to the owners and the commissioner. So, right, I'm saying that if we're going to make a reckoning with that time, then let's include probably the best natural player of that entire era, who is Barry Bonds.
Let's talk about some of the other people who you say are complicit. You describe former manager and baseball Hall of Famer now, Tony La Russa, as the great enabler. Make your case.
Sure. I mean, over the time that he managed, and I have no doubt he was a terrific manager, but look, beginning with Oakland, where he oversaw both Canseco and McGuire, if you recall back to that time, again, these guys look like Popeye. And so you wonder, well, you know, Tony, you're a really bright guy. What did you think when all of a sudden, you know, they start hitting 70 home runs? Maybe I'm picking on La Russa in a way that I'm arguing we shouldn't do with anyone. I mean, in the sense that much of baseball, Joe Torre and the Yankees oversaw all kinds of players who started putting up just whack-a-doo numbers. And you start saying, well, you know, did you really know nothing, or did you just choose to be kind of willfully blind?
Outgoing Commissioner Bud Selig also incurs your wrath. Should Selig's reputation be as tarnished as the reputation of Barry Bonds?
I would argue yes. There, I think the record is very clear. There were people in the medical community who are saying, look, this is really bad for people. It's bad for those athletes, but it's also bad for, you know, kids at high school and college level who started modeling their behavior on the behavior of pro athletes. Mm-hmm. And baseball really until, you know, well into 2007, 2008, 2009, really did very little.
Other players from baseball's steroid era have been forgiven. Mark McGuire serves as a hitting coach for the Dodgers. What has made it so difficult, at least for fans outside of San Francisco, to forgive Barry Bonds?
I think, you know, look, I mean, Bonds had a reputation for being a bit surly, or maybe more than a bit surly, but I think it probably goes even beyond that, because let's face it, McGuire was not an exceptionally outgoing character himself. Take roids entirely out of the picture, and you'll still find Bonds as the most preternaturally talented athlete of his generation. His production went so off the charts once he started to use that it really kind of called the question on steroids in a way that other players didn't. Mm-hmm. Because I would almost look at Bonds as like a figure out of Greek myth. Let's use these words advisedly, but in that context, he was almost godlike in his talent. And in a weird way, I think we ended up turning him into a villain in a way that was kind of disproportionate to others who were clearly using.
Michael Powell is a sports columnist for the New York Times, and you can find a link to his article for Barry Bonds, A Decade of Inflated Blame for the Steroid Era, at onlyagame.org. Michael, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks very much. Enjoyed it.
Is it time to forgive Barry Bonds, or is it at least time to remember his transgressions in the context of the era during which he committed them? Let us know what you think. You can weigh in on our Facebook page, facebook.com/onlyagamenpr, or add your comment on our website, onlyagame.org. The Detroit Lions have missed the playoffs 13 of the last 14 seasons, and that stat doesn't quite capture the Lions' struggles. Since 2001, Detroit has had just one winning season. This year, though, the Lions are off to a promising start, winning 5 of their first 7 games. Kyle Mahnke covers the team for MLive Media Group. Kyle, how are Lions fans reacting to the team's success?
Well, I think there's a lot of surprise, Bill. I mean, you name some stats. There's also the one that they've won one playoff game in nearly 60 years. So we're talking about epic levels of failure here.
Yeah, I laugh, but I'm sure that's not funny to people in Detroit.
Well, there's some kind of gallows humor to it, I think.
You note that two of the team's biggest stars are offensive players, and you write Detroit has been known as an offensive team for years. Is it safe to say that's changed?
This is a team that's really built itself around offense, dating back to the days of Barry Sanders. And, you know, they have Calvin Johnson now, the best receiver in the game. And they spent an offseason surrounding Calvin Johnson and his quarterback, Matthew Stafford, with a lot of offensive toys. And so this team was supposed to score a lot of points. And they've been one of the worst in the NFL this year at scoring points. But the defense has been very good. They're number one in the league, and it's surprising a lot of people.
One of the cogs of the Lions' defense is George Johnson, and nobody saw him coming because Johnson was cut by Minnesota last October and spent the rest of the year out of work. What has he done to become such a key part of Detroit's success so far?
You know, in the NFL, if you're not one of the team's best players, it's very common to get cut and to get resigned. There's a very quick turnover with teams. And the thing that's unique about him is that when he was cut by Minnesota last year, it was in the middle of the season. He's 25 years old at the peak of his athletic abilities, and nobody resigned him. He was literally on his couch. He and his wife thought his career was over. I mean, he was looking at jobs and insurance and stuff like that. The Lions saw something in him they liked, and they brought him in, and they had him lose some weight. And that was the big difference for him, is he lost about 20 pounds. He just plays like a different player. And being with the Lions have one of the best defensive lines in the National Football League. And being surrounded by so many great players has helped free up George Johnson to have a really surprising and spectacular year so far.
All right. Now, Kyle, the last thing I want to do is be a killjoy with respect to this story. But last year, the Lions got off to a 6-3 start before dropping six of their final seven games. Is this year going to be different?
I mean, it's a fair question because the Lions have had good starts in the past, including that 6-3 start you alluded to last year. And this year's roster is almost identical. I mean, even if you talk about the defense, which is so much better this year, nine of the starters were players for the team last year. The biggest difference with this team, and this is what they would tell you if you were to ask them this question, is their coach. You know, they fired Jim Schwartz after last season, and they hired Jim Caldwell. And one of the reasons why they hired Caldwell is because he's known around league circles as being a calm guy, a mature guy. He whittles away the highs and the lows and keeps the team pretty even keeled. And it sounds like a lot of coach speak, but if you are around the team every day, you could feel the team last year really getting sucked into their high, their 6-3 start. And as soon as they lost two games coming off of that start, it all fell apart. Everything just snowballed. Mm. And this year, when stuff doesn't go right, this team perseveres.
Kyle Mankey covers the Lions for MLive Media Group. Kyle, thank you very much for speaking with me, and good luck as the Lions proceed.
Thank you so much. Anytime.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, sports writer extraordinaire Bob Ryan stops by for a look back at his career. But first, less than 6 months ago, Los Angeles Clippers owner Donald Sterling was banned from the NBA. Sterling was forced to sell his team to former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer for $2 billion, and then he sued the league for $1 billion in damages. We're tired of talking about all that, so we invited Ben Bulch of the LA Times to talk about how the Clippers are faring as a basketball team. Ben, the NBA regular season begins on Tuesday. This is a circumstance you've described as, quote, merciful, so I take it the Clippers have not had a great preseason.
Yeah, that's certainly one way to put it. They've been mixing and matching lineups, resting star players, and trying to see what works and what doesn't. So their slow play in the preseason is not really a big concern for them, but they are ready to get going. In fact, I've had several players say that they would wish that the playoffs started this week instead of the regular season because they're so eager to atone for what happened last year when people thought that they had a chance to make the NBA Finals and fell a little bit short of that.
On Wednesday, Steve Ballmer attended his first home game since buying the Clippers back in August, and one of your colleagues wrote that when Ballmer saw himself on the Jumbotron, he, quote, started clapping so intensely that it looked as if he might injure himself. Did that inspire the team to play any better?
I think they really do get a kick out of his energy and his enthusiasm for winning. Frankly, he's bringing a presence that I don't know that we've seen in the NBA. I mean, Mark Cuban certainly is visible, but I don't know if he's as voluble as Steve Ballmer. So this is going to be something that's going to be interesting to track all season long as to his role in games as an entertainer.
Blake Griffin has been key to the Clippers' success since being named Rookie of the Year after the 2010-2011 season, but last week Griffin vowed to, quote, stand up for himself more after hard fouls, and then over the weekend he allegedly stood up for himself a bit too aggressively with a zealous fan. Should Coach Doc Rivers be worried about his star?
I don't think so. I think that what happened in Las Vegas, we don't know, you know, the full story, only the allegations. He did surprise some people with those comments about standing up for himself, and you have to wonder, you know, the next time somebody like Serge Ibaka from Oklahoma City elbows him a little too viciously, what is he going to do? Is he going to retaliate? He's done a great job so far in his career of restraining himself, but the day may be coming where that changes.
What, if any, other concerns does Doc Rivers have as the season begins?
Last year in the playoffs, they had an epic meltdown in Game 5 and never really recovered from that. So when things get tough, how is this team going to respond? Last season, obviously, with the Donald Sterling situation, that was something nobody could anticipate or prepare for. And even though they got through that first round and really weathered that storm, I feel like they did kind of get an adrenaline rush from that and kind of ran out of gas in the second round against Oklahoma City. So not anticipating anything like that happening this year that they'll have to deal with.
I can't resist asking just one more question about the ongoing Sterling saga. Last week, Mr. Sterling withdrew his lawsuit against the league and his wife for fraud, but only so he could better focus on his federal antitrust lawsuit against the NBA. Do you have any sense at all of how this is ultimately all going to shake out?
Well, I'm not going to pretend to be a legal expert, but at this point, he's pretty much throwing Hail Marys with everything he's doing in court. So I don't anticipate any of this to shake out in his favor. I think that he's already indemnified as part of the sale agreement between his wife and Steve Ballmer, the league and the Clippers, against lawsuits. So in effect, he's essentially suing himself. So I don't really see this overturning anything or resulting in any kind of big financial award for Donald Sterling.
Ben Bulch covers the Clippers for the LA Times. Ben, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
From 1993 to 2011, approximately 3,100 students at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, nearly half of them athletes, took courses that were in fact no-show classes that required students to simply turn in one paper. Even poorly written plagiarized papers received A's and B's. That's just one of the findings in a report by former FBI General Counsel Kenneth Weinstein, which was released on Wednesday. Joining me now is Dan Kane, a member of the investigative team at the News and Observer newspaper in Raleigh, North Carolina. Dan, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thanks for having me on your show.
In 2011, you first uncovered academic concerns regarding some UNC football players, and since then, widespread problems in the university's African Studies Department and in the Athletic Department have been revealed. What details in this new report stood out particularly to you?
Well, first of all, just the fact that this report acknowledges or proves that this was an athletic scandal. Because for, you know, really about 3 years, you know, the university had been pretty adamant at times saying this did not have an athletic motive. This was just a secretary in an African Studies department and the chairman of the department who basically were just, you know, anybody needing one of these things to come and get it. But the Weinstein report clearly shows that a lot of this was really driven by the academic support program for student athletes. You know, they were trying to keep their guys eligible. They kind of, you know, pressured Debbie Crowder and Julius Nyangoro to help them out.
Tell us a little bit about the role of faculty member Jan Boxill.
She's a former basketball coach, very close to the women's basketball team, and those were the students she generally counseled. You know, she became the faculty leader. She was elected the faculty leader in 2011, just as this academic scandal is starting to break. The faculty could try to conduct their own review into what happened and why. I happened to get a prior draft of that report, and there was a pretty interesting change in it with regard to Debbie Crowder. Her name was taken out, and her ties to the athletic department, her closeness to athletic officials, was removed. And come to find out, it was Jan Boxill that had suggested that that be taken out. And what she wrote was along the lines of, this could bring the NCAA back. And but now here's this report comes out, and it turns out Jan was, you know, steering athletes to these classes, and in a couple of cases suggested grades for the papers that they would write.
Well, you mentioned the women's basketball team. It sounds to me like it wasn't just, as far as athletes are concerned, it wasn't just football players and male basketball players.
This was across all sports. I think just probably just about every sport on campus had at least a couple of students who were in these things.
This week you wrote, and I'm quoting now, five members of the 2005 championship basketball team accounted for at least 52 classes that were either accurately characterized as independent study or were identified as confirmed or suspected no-show classes. Roy Williams was the coach of that championship team. He's still the coach. Do you see this scandal creating problems for him?
You know, Roy, when he came here in, I think, 2003, realized that, you know, a lot of his players were majoring in this particular department. But what he does do, according to the report, is he kind of tells his staff, I'd kind of like to get these kids kind of in some other areas of study. His academic counselor, a guy by the name of Wayne Walden, who he brought to North Carolina from Kansas, this is a guy he really trusted. Wayne admitted that he knew that Debbie was grading some of these papers. But Wayne Walden says that he doesn't recall telling Roy that.
In 2011, the university fired head football coach Butch Davis and accepted the retirement of athletic director Dick Bedour for another scandal involving improper benefits and questionable tutoring. Where does the NCAA stand on this matter?
So the NCAA was, you know, heavily involved in that. Sanctions were delivered. They had pretty much wrapped that up when I started producing this information about this strange thing that was going on in that African Studies department. They did bring the NCAA back, but the NCAA basically came back and said, if this whole scandal was not intended to, you know, specifically benefit athletes, then it's really none of our business. It's the university's business. And so now they're back. They've been back since June. This report obviously will give them an awful lot of evidence, but in terms of knowing what they're going to do, it's very hard to predict.
Dan, UNC traditionally is one of those schools that has always claimed to be educating its athletes, and I think most people thought that that was the case. I would gather that this story would seriously damage the university's image.
Well, that's obviously in the eyes of the public, but I think it's fair to say that they have taken a pretty big hit over this. There's been kind of a acknowledgement that this whole, you know, they called it the Carolina way, this sort of mantra, you know, at Carolina wasn't really true.
Dan Kane is a member of the investigative team at the News and Observer newspaper in Raleigh, North Carolina. Dan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thanks again for having me on your show.
In Scribe, subtitled My Life in Sports, Bob Ryan discourses on everything from basketball to cross-country skiing, though he is perhaps best known for his coverage of the NBA. Ryan's range over the past five decades has been enormous. The author joins me now. Bob Ryan, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thank you for having me, Bill.
The book is titled Scribe, and that's a nickname you picked up at the Lawrenceville School in New Jersey. Tell me a little bit about that.
It came about because I was kind of the sports guy in the class of 64, in that I was a football manager, I was a basketball player, and I was on track at that point in the junior year to being the sports editor of the school paper, and I was known for that. And the football coach, Jack Rydell, nicknamed me Scribe, and it stuck. It stuck in that community. It became how I was known. And for the last 50 years in the Lawrenceville community, right from the headmaster on down, I have been known as Scribe.
You had two long stretches covering the Boston Celtics, and at one point you realized you had become, as you write in Scribe, emotionally invested in the team. What are the advantages and the disadvantages of that circumstance?
I think the advantages are the passion that you bring to the writing to the benefit of the reader. The negative, as I found out in that first incarnation from 1969 to 76, when I was in my 20s, by the way, is that it was wearying. It was hard. I felt at the end of the 1975-76 season washed out. Somehow or other, it was wearying on me to care too much about the fortunes of this team and the individual players.
Did the players know that you were too emotionally invested?
No. They knew I cared about them. They knew I was interested. They certainly knew I was a basketball-oriented person, and I had made these legitimate friendships with the like of John Havlicek, Dave Cowens, Paul Silas, one of my all-time favorite people, and Paul Westfall, to name four.
You are perhaps best known for your work as a basketball writer. Your colleagues nicknamed you the commissioner, but you maintain and scribe that your favorite sport to cover is golf. How did that happen?
Well, it's because of logistics. It's a simple matter of the reality that television dominates sports, but the one sport that television cannot mess up for the print writer is golf. It's in the daylight. And therefore, you can write what you want to write without the encumbrance of an onerous deadline. And it wouldn't matter, though, if I didn't like golf. But I do like golf, and I enjoy the whole rhythm of a golf tournament.
And are you a player as well?
I've been playing on and off since I was 12. I probably peaked at 15. Seriously, never had a lesson. That's the big mistake. I learned how to grip the club from an older friend. I read golf magazine and launched my golf career.
There's a phrase that jumped out at me from the book. Actually, there were several, but here's one. Concerning the achievement of David Halberstam, you describe his work as celebrated in both the real world and the world of sports. Why is that?
Oh, you know, in the intellectual world and the news world, the sports department has always been nicknamed the toy department. There's a certain condescension that the world of journalism has about sports, and I understand that. It doesn't deal with real life issues, except when it does, you know. such as this we'll call controversy in the NFL. You know, some good has come out of the whole Ray Rice thing. But in general terms, we're talking about people playing games, and it's a source of derision in some circles.
Your chapter about pro football is titled, I Can Hardly Believe It's Legal. What particulars about the game led you to decide on that title?
It's a brutal, barbaric game of carnage. It's a game that literally maims people, that if you were going to play it at a high level, college football or professionally, it's a very good chance that you will be afflicted for the rest of your life with problems with your back, your shoulder, your elbow, your arm, your neck, your ankle, whatever. In addition to which, we now know for sure, there is a frightening chance you will have cognitive impairment way too early. The NFL has actually said this year that one out of three players playing can expect to have this problem as they age. So step back. This is America's favorite game. This is the game we've chosen as our favorite game. What does it say about us as a society? And I say in the beginning of the chapter what the premise of the game is if I were explaining it to someone who had never seen it before. And I would like to think that when you explain the premise of this game and the way it's waged, that the person would say, that's legal?
Bob, you used to be one of those sports writers who felt soccer was a silly game because only one of the players could use his hands. I heard you say that at a women's professional soccer championship game. Have your views on the sport softened at all over the years?
I certainly have, in that I certainly have come to appreciate all the things that people enjoy about it, the artistry and the teamwork and the spectacular skills. I think covering the World Cup in 94, Bill, here, getting a taste of the international flavor really did broaden my viewpoint. And unfinished business in my personal life would be to get a chance to attend some major international matches in Europe.
The state of newspapers being what it is, a lot of people know you primarily as a television personality because of your regular appearances on the Sports Reporters, Pardon the Interruption, and Around the Horn. Do you have as much fun doing TV work as it looks like you're having?
I enjoy those programs, yes, but in particular, Pardon the Interruption. That format is right up my alley. It suits me ideally as well, I believe, and I enjoy that. That is the single most amount of fun one can have in television, in my judgment, is being one of those two people on Pardon the Interruption.
Talk a little bit, as we conclude this, about how sports writing has changed since the creation of the internet and the huge popularity of social media, and speculate about how sports coverage will evolve as the years go on.
The nature of the actual writing has not changed, just that the writers are now being distributed differently and electronically rather than print. But here's the difference. It's the instantaneous nature of forcing people into this frenzied competition just to get something out there. In the old days, if I had a story, a scoop, and I could write it, I could go home, eat dinner, I would know that when the paper was put on people's doorsteps in the morning, it was going to be there. Today, if you get a piece of information, it must be, A, tweeted immediately, and then it must be put on your paper's website. And then, only then, does it go in the paper, whereby tomorrow morning it's old news. And I ask you this. Most of this frenzy and that people have to be first involves two things, trades or signings. Are they that important that people have to go nuts daily over this? But that's what they do.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, why it's important to announce that somebody's ankle is sore 5 minutes earlier than somebody else announces that, or a trade or a signing.
Yeah. No, but that it's seldom about matters of real importance. Oh, unless, of course, a player oversleeps and misses practice.
Bob Ryan, the author of Scribe, subtitled My Life in Sports. Bob, thanks very much for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I've written a review of Scribe that you can find on onlyagame.org, and there you can also read an excerpt of the book. Coming up on Only a Game, Ashes to Ashes? Nope, Ashes to Kansas City. We'll have a story of how Royals broadcaster Denny Matthews is honoring the last wishes of his childhood friend. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill. I'd like to tell our listeners that Take Me Out by Bill Littlefield, available at finer bookstores and finer computer screens around your living room, is currently ranked 74,849 on the Amazon list.
Whoa, up from 300,000-something.
Wow, that's a many percent improvement.
Thank you for the mention. I appreciate it. Charlie, last week I predicted the charming story of the Royals' run through the playoffs might inspire many people to watch the World Series, and you thought not, and now the numbers are in, so do you wish to present those numbers and then gloat?
I don't wish to gloat because it's too bad, but this was the most inevitable thing that happened. 12 million people watched the opening game between the Kansas City Royals and the San Francisco Giants. This was headed this way, you know, from the minute they both won their respective pennants. It's too bad. The other problem they have is that this series could have caught on if the first three games had been really, really good games. And game one was a 7-1 loss, which sort of deflated the plucky little Royals storyline. So now it's just an ordinary World Series with a couple of teams nobody's heard of.
Tampa Bay Rays manager Joe Maddon has opted out of his contract. The team was 77-85 this season, so was it time for Madden's 9-year tenure with the Rays to end?
I think Maddon thinks it was. I think he was looking down the road and thinking, gee, I've ridden this horse as far as I can. He will be in demand, obviously. The Dodgers have already said, well, that has nothing to do with us, but I think we can wait a month and it will have something to do with them.
Steve Nash, in the third year of his contract with the L.A. Lakers, has already been ruled out for the 2014-2015 season due to a back injury. Some have predicted that Nash's career is over. Is there hope that a 40-year-old can still stage a comeback?
Not from back problems. Back problems are the end of a career, and back problems can be the end of a career when you're 25, let alone 40.
I know that you have written about the shootings in Ottawa, Charlie, and on Wednesday night, hockey fans in Pittsburgh indicated that they were also aware of those tragedies.
Yeah, ordinarily in an NHL game, they play the two national anthems only if one of the teams is based in Canada. But on the other night, in a game between Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, they played both anthems. They put the lyrics to O Canada up on the Jumbotron so people could follow along. I thought it was really terrific.
Ray Rice, suspended for two games by the NFL for domestic violence and cut by the Baltimore Ravens after a video of the incident became public, filed a grievance against the team this week. Rice says the collective bargaining agreement allows only one punishment per infraction, and therefore the Ravens owe him $3.52 million. Does he have a case?
He does, actually. What happened here, if you remember the timeline, was that there was an original two-game suspension, and then all hell broke loose. And in reaction to his original bungling, Roger Goodell decided to get tough and suspended Rice indefinitely. I'm not entirely sure he could do that under the collective bargaining agreement, and it's going to be a horrible story for Roger Goodell if Ray Rice wins this particular arbitration because Roger Goodell couldn't do the right thing the first time.
In his report on academic fraud at the University of North Carolina, an investigator found that over nearly two decades, 3,100 students, almost half of them athletes, received bogus grades. Would you like to estimate how many NCAA penalties those numbers are likely to add up to?
I'm wondering if the NCAA isn't going to let North Carolina handle this itself, because this is yet another shot below the waterline of what the NCAA pretends to be. Which is that it pretends to have anything whatsoever to do with academics. North Carolina was renowned for its ability to both educate its athletes and have athletes who produce national championships. This is really awful.
Meanwhile, the NCAA is reportedly investigating improprieties among Syracuse University's men's basketball and football programs. Charlie, those allegations only go back one decade, so maybe we should expect the NCAA to be lenient there.
Again, the NCAA is sort of stuck. It doesn't have the moral and ethical credibility to issue any sanctions anymore that people won't laugh at. But, you know, it continues to, like, mindlessly go about its job.
Something called Huddle Pass, allegedly the official voice of former college athletes, polled 280 former college football players, and 85.7% said they had teammates who'd received illegal benefits. And 42% of the respondents said that they themselves had received such benefits. Do these numbers seem credible to you?
First of all, Huddle Pass.
Huddle Pass.
It's important to pronounce it Huddle Pass. Anyway, I like the difference between 85.7% of the athletes saying they knew somebody who had gotten illegal benefits and the 42% that say that was them who got the illegal benefits. This reminds me of, hey, doc, I got a friend who, you know. This antibiotic isn't for me, but I got this friend who, you know.
You might expect that as the 1988 NFL MVP, former Cincinnati Bengals quarterback Boomer Esiason wouldn't be interested in taking a job that offers television viewers an alternative to the Super Bowl. What's Mr. Esiason hoping that folks will watch instead?
He's become the commissioner of Cute, Bill.
Oh.
And not Huddle Pass
Huddle
either.
Pass.
No, not Huddle Pass. The Feline Football League,
oh,
which produces the Kiddie Bowl, which people watch when they're half drunk on Super Bowl Sunday and go, oh, before throwing up in the wastebasket.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Do you have a burning question you'd like to ask Charlie? Email your query to onlyagame@wbur.org. Leave it on our listener line, 617-353-1860, or tweet it at us at onlyagamenpr, hashtag AskCharlie. And maybe you'll hear your question on the air.
Boy, are we asking for trouble.
And now we bring you a story that gives a whole new meaning to the phrase, take me out to the ballgame. New Hampshire resident Marty Cappadice died in October 2013, and in his will, he had stipulated that his ashes should be divided into packets and spread at places and events that he would have enjoyed, like baseball games. And he had a special connection to baseball. His best friend, Denny Matthews, has been broadcasting the Kansas City Royals game since 1969. So when Cappadice's wife contacted Matthews about spreading some of the ashes at the World Series, he said yes. Joining me now is Denny Matthews, who's in San Francisco to broadcast the Fall Classic. Denny, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
And Marty Cappadice's wife, Arnie Arneson, joins me now from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio. Arnie, welcome, and please accept my condolences about your husband.
He'd be slapping me five right now if he knew what was going on. So no condolences necessary. This is pure joy.
All right. Arnie, you've been the one having family and friends carry out your husband's wishes. Did you know right away that baseball would be part of this plan?
Yes. And let me tell you why. When we had the huge celebration of his life, 600 of his closest friends showed up and I was handing out his ashes. I decided that I wanted to tell everyone about the perfect table I would set for my husband. And it began with Only a Game's irreverent analyst, Charlie Pierce. And it ended with Stan Musial. And then sure enough, all the pieces are falling together because I get to be on Only a Game with you and Charlie Pierce, and Denny Matthews, his beloved friend, is going to be calling the games in the World Series. Oh, my God.
Denny, when you got that call from Arnie saying, I would like to send you some of Marty's ashes to spread at the World Series games, how did you respond?
I told her it was a perfect idea. I thought it was tremendous, and I wouldn't have it any other way. I thought it was a great idea and a great concept.
Now, I understand that you and Marty had been best friends since you were in kindergarten, which is extraordinary. You're in the Baseball Hall of Fame, of course, for your career as the voice of the Royals. Marty was a loyal St. Louis Cardinals fan. How much of a role did baseball play in that remarkably long friendship?
Well, it was one of the first common threads. And I can recall we played American Legion junior baseball. You can play from the time, at least in Bloomington Normal, Illinois, where we grew up, 7 years old and on up. And Marty and I played through high school baseball together. I remember Marty was a catcher when we first started playing. And I said, Marty, you're not a catcher. You just don't look like a catcher or act like a catcher. You're an outfielder. So he played outfield the rest. And he said, by the way, you're not a pitcher either. And I played infield. So we had each other pretty well scouted and pegged with regard to our early baseball skills. Great days, great memories in that regard.
Denny, after decades of working in the game, I wonder if you have any thoughts about what makes baseball such a passion for fans that they even want to make it part of the way they're remembered after they're gone.
I think everybody has played baseball in some form or other, softball, fastball. Well, it's a generational thing, and fathers to sons, sons to their sons, and daughters, and on down the line. And I can recall when I was 3 or 4 years old, my father, by the way, the St. Louis Cardinals baseball broadcast was always on in our house. I remember one day he said, "Do you like living in this house?" And I said, "Well, yeah, Dad. I really like our house." And he said, "Well, good, because if you don't root for the Cardinals, you won't live in this house." And he was kidding, obviously, but the point was made. And, of course, Marty and I grew up Cardinal fans, and that was another bond between us.
Arnie, I have heard stories before of Cubs fans who were so devout that they wanted their ashes spread over Wrigley Field, or Red Sox fans who wanted to be remembered because of an association with Fenway Park. But it sounds as if this is, with Marty, this is a case of any baseball field will do. I mean, from Little League on up, right?
You nailed it, honey. I mean, this is the man who would read me the new Bill James historical abstract at night. Understand, this was our bedtime reading. I mean, God help me. He has been everywhere. He's been to spring training. He's been to baseball fields. He's been to Australia. But everyone knew that if they could be anywhere near a baseball field, his ashes had to go there. So I just want to let you know this. I think it's magic, and I hope other people can do the same kind of magic.
Arnie Arneson is a talk show host and a political analyst. Her husband, Marty Cappadice, died last fall. Arnie, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It was a pleasure.
Marty's best friend, Denny Matthews, is the voice of the Kansas City Royals. Denny, thank you very much for joining us.
You are very welcome. I've enjoyed it.
This weekend marks the grand opening of the Museum of the History of Polish Jews, which is built on the grounds of the former Warsaw Ghetto. The main exhibit presents artifacts from the thousand-year history of Jews in Poland. The weekend also marks the rematch of two club soccer teams that revived a historic rivalry this past summer with the help of the international Jewish sports organization Maccabi. Hannah Morris reports.
It's a hot summer day at a local park in Krakow, Poland. Fans lean on fences around the bleachers and wait for the game to begin between Team Warsaw and Team Krakow. Team Warsaw's left field Daria Zimiewa warms up with pregame stretches.
I'm a little bit afraid of Krakow team.
Do you think they're good?
Yeah, I think they are professional almost.
Amid the usual soccer spectacles is something a little different. There are Stars of David printed on the right side of Team Warsaw's black jerseys. Unlike their predecessors 7 years ago in Poland, these Jews wear them voluntarily. Den Petrovsky, a fan of the team, cheers for his friends.
I really didn't actually believe that I'd be here one day and looking at them actually playing against another Jewish team, so I'm here to support them. Someone said yesterday that it's actually the first Jewish game in 7 years that's taking place in Poland, so it's actually a historical event.
Jewish life was thriving in Poland in the 1930s. There were more than 400 synagogues in Warsaw alone. And between World War I and World War II, 100 Jewish soccer teams were legally registered in the country. Their athletes included championship boxers, wrestlers, and weightlifters. There was a community of young people who weren't just focused on survival. They were focused on living full, healthy lives. That is until 1939, when Nazis and their Polish collaborators began to obliterate Jewish culture and Jews. During Nazi occupation, all Poles were banned from playing games whatsoever. Some were banned from everyday activities that most people take for granted.
My grandmother, she was born in Berlin, but her entire family is from Łódź in Poland. One of these sons was shot by a Nazi in Warsaw. He was walking on the sidewalk and the Nazi told him to get off and he didn't, and he was killed on the spot.
That's Maayan St. Anton. She's a young American Jew living in Warsaw and the vice head of her local Maccabi chapter. Today, young Jews play soccer not far from the Auschwitz concentration camp.
It was less about it's 40 miles away from the place where all of our family members died, and more of about we were Jewish before the Holocaust. We had Jewish football clubs. We had Jewish synagogues. We had Jewish political movements, and now we're trying to reclaim that. So when we think about Auschwitz, we don't think about Auschwitz. This is Krakow, because Krakow's a really interesting, large city in Poland that's fun to go to on the weekends.
Another soccer fan, Matusz Majman, stands in the bleachers. He majors in Hebrew studies at Warsaw University.
I have an aunt. She's 102. She started her 102nd year, and she was a member of Maccabi since 1928 till 1939. When I spoke with her family members, and I told them that Maccabi started again in Poland, so it was really exciting for them. And for me, it's like something really cool that it's really happening, yeah?
Matusz is part of a new generation. He was born in a world without Nazis or communists in power.
For us, it's nothing problematic to call ourselves Jews. We're just the first generation that can talk openly about this subject and can do something.
Some young Poles only recently learned they were Jewish. Their parents and grandparents grew up in Nazi-occupied and then in communist Poland without Jewish soccer teams. Now being Jewish can be a source of pride. Here's Ma'ayan again.
You can have this synagogue, but it doesn't mean you have a community. It means you have Jews. And so when you have something that is not specifically religious, it means that you have a community.
That's why the young Jews of Poland have deliberately revived soccer. The Maccabi Warsaw team isn't just about the religion, the dark history, or remembrance. It's active. It's about the now and establishing a long-term future for Jews in Poland.
Maccabi Warsaw almost scored.
Team Warsaw beats Team Krakow 5-3. The teams shower in the locker rooms, and Team Warsaw celebrates their victory at the Krakow Jewish Community Center. That's where I catch up with Team Warsaw's coach Karol Strzemieszny.
So it's so natural to bring back any kind of like organizations that could still work and that still people would love. I think everybody in Warsaw would want a club like this to still be here, you know? Mm-hmm. I really wonder how far this could go.
For Only a Game, I'm Hannah Morris in Warsaw.
Our story was produced by Shara Morris and Jennifer Rice for Homemade News. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is James Trout. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. And we had help this week from Dave DeWitt at North Carolina Public Radio. Our intern is Eric Larrabee, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from Bob Ryan. Although he appreciates soccer, he worries that one of the game's rules is preventing more Americans from doing the same.
It is the only game of our favorite games in which hands do not play a role except for one person. And I think it's part of the things that blocks Americans from embracing the game.
Now, I was in the studio with Bob when I interviewed him, and he didn't use his hands, and I found the interview to be entertaining nonetheless. I just wish he hadn't flopped so often. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.